We've been talking with Lynn Picknett and Clive Prince, their ongoing research into, I guess it would be too tough to say all things Templar, but certainly crypto history in many ways, and new books coming out and new research on old books of the past. The Turin Shroud was one of their books that was just fascinating. It was just so interesting, making the case for Leonardo da Vinci's face on the Turin Shroud. And you did that a long time before the whole Da Vinci Code thing. You were doing that in the early 90s, weren't you?
Yeah, we were researching that, as you say, in the early 90s. It came out, Turin Shroud came out in 1994. Oh, I went blank there for a minute. Fancy forgetting our first book. Yes, 1994. And it's had two revisions, certainly in this country, since, two updates, one in 2000 and one last year. So we've been very lucky there.
Yeah, and it's a really interesting book. Now, but I'm going to force you to take a minute or two to tell the story of this serendipitous kind of re-verification, would you call it, of your theory?
Yeah, but basically, yes, because what we'd argued back in 1994 was that, as you know, Leonardo da Vinci was the person that created the Turin Shroud, created the image on the shroud, and we said that he'd used. Well, there were kind of two sides to the argument that we put forward back then. One is that this mysterious image that nobody can explain how it got there, we could explain it. We explained it by making our own one. And essentially, we found that the only way you can actually make this kind of image is using a very, very early form of photography. That's why the image on the Turin Shroud is so lifelike. It's also why it exhibits all the properties of a photographic negative, because that's what it is. So that was one side to it, and that it was done in the late Middle Ages, early Renaissance. And so we were able to show that by using the materials and technology that were available at that time to produce our own shroud images that had all the characteristics everyone had always said was miraculous. The other side to it was, okay, that was how it was done, who did it? And the person that we fingered as responsible was Leonardo da Vinci, because although you could do these things with the material and technology of the day, you still needed to be a bit of a genius to work out that you could do that. And we presented in the original book what, you know, was in the end circumstantial evidence that Leonardo was in the right place and the right time and knew the right people to have been able to do this, and also that the face of the man on the shroud does bear a very, very striking resemblance to Leonardo's own face.
Right. Yeah.
So in short, what we were saying, and it sounds crazy when we put it in short like this, we were saying that the Turin Shroud is not only a 500-year-old photograph by Leonardo da Vinci, we're saying it's a 500-year-old photograph of Leonardo da Vinci. But it was kind of a circumstantial case, and since then we've been trying to see, is there any way we can actually prove this a bit more? And the thing our critics always hit us with was, you know, there is no documented connection between Leonardo and the Turin Shroud whatsoever. You know, no record that, you know, he ever saw it or ever went anywhere near it. And then what happened, it was just we got this, the latest update, which came out last year, and it is available in the States. And you know, we changed actually quite a lot of the book, because there was a lot of new kind of historical information. And just as a kind of last-minute thing, something we'd always wanted to do. Leonardo da Vinci did this painting towards the end of his life called the Salvator Mundi, Savior of the World, and it was a painting ostensibly of Jesus. And it's the only painting in which he'd painted Jesus looking out straight at the viewer in the same way that the man on the shroud does. And way back in the early 90s, we kind of think maybe we could do some kind of comparison and see if these two things connect up. And basically, we didn't, because one, at that time, it would have been way too complicated with, you know, copying images and scaling them up and transferring, you know, connecting one to the other, comparing them. And also, the thing is, when you actually look at the two images, the Salvator Mundi and the man on the shroud, they actually don't look very much alike. They're looking in the same direction, but the faces don't look too similar. And just, so it was literally, we'd given the updated version to the publishers, and I was just kind of sitting around. Strange enough, I'd just moved flat, and I had boxes and boxes of books, and I'd opened a box, and at the top of it was a big colour book all about the Salvator Mundi. And it just kind of was laying there, and I thought, maybe we should have another look at this. And it suddenly occurred to me, with all the kind of software you get free with your computers these days, doing that comparison is a lot easier now, because all you've got to do is scan two images, get them to the same size, and you can actually overlay one on the other and see whether, you know, the eyes match up and the mouth matches up and all that kind of thing. So I just kind of spent maybe an hour just kind of doing that and overlaid one on the other, and the two just match up just absolutely perfectly in every detail. When you, the visuals we have on the website actually just simply doing that. It's overlaying one image on the other and gradually making the top one more and more transparent so the one underneath shows through. And it's actually kind of, when you see it, it's very, very kind of scary. In fact, almost looks like he's on 2 hours opening his eyes up and looking at you.
It was very funny because Clive phoned me and said, I think I've made a discovery, but, because Clive is very cautious, you see. He said, I think I've made a discovery, but I could be wrong. So he came round with his laptop and showed me. And, of course, I was jumping up and down screaming and bouncing off the walls. You know, that's me. That's why we get on so well. We're so different, you know. But it was just jaw-dropping. And the fact, I mean, anybody can see that actually in front of their own eyes developing, on, you know, if they look on our website, it's there. But it was just what we've been looking for. I mean, it doesn't prove anything more than Leonardo was very familiar with the Shroud, but it's a huge step in the right direction for us.
It's either, you know, the Salvatore Mundi is either based on the Turin Shroud, or it's the hugest coincidence ever. And just, as it's not, you know, as it's by the person that we'd already got some evidence that he was the person that did it, it's just, you know, the odds just go way beyond that. The other thing about it is if you actually measure the two images as, you know, in life, they are exactly the same size as well. So it's not just that you know, one's a small image, right, you can scale it up. So it at least proves that our critic's wrong, that there is a connection between Leonardo and the Shroud. You know,
that's where we'll leave it. We'll take a bunch more calls coming up, and we'll find out where your research has intersected with other lives and other questions and other comments. To the rest of this hour, it's you and Clive Prince and Lynn Picknett on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Spending the rest of the hour with your calls for Lynn and Clive. John is on the wildcard line on Coast to Coast AM. John?
Wondering if the people knew of any of Jesus' miracles, such as walking water to wine, or feeding 5,000 with loaves and fishes, could be attributed to any physical thing, any substantial reality there.
Hello, John. Taking the water into wine, unfortunately, that never happened, because, I mean, it seems it never happened. What it was actually the gospel writers basically were taking a story that was attributed to a pagan god, Dionysus, and basically rewriting it with Jesus' name on it. I mean, it seems that. And also the feeding of the 5,000 doesn't appear actually to have been an actual miracle. It appears to have been a political meeting.
Oh, my God.
So, I mean... Yes. This is all, you know, it's all been rewritten. We have to bear in mind...
The whole political thing about walking on water never happened too, either?
I'm not sure about walking water. Clive will no doubt know about that.
Well, let me just add one thing. In Velikovsky, right, when the comet was sweeping by, when Venus had become a new entity in the solar system, it spread edible fungus in the tail, and it was called manna. And in the desert, the Israelites, or the children, were able to eat this manna that fell from the sky. And in a coincidence of events, possibly Jesus was hanging out there feeding people this manna, you know, you say he had a Mediterranean-wide influence during his period, right?
No, John the Baptist did.
Oh, well, where was Jesus local to? Didn't he ever go to Egypt or anything? I mean...
Well, there is the story, isn't there, the flight into Egypt to get away from Herod's men when Jesus was a baby. And certainly, as we said in Temple Revelation, Jesus does appear to have been heavily influenced by the Egyptians, by the Egyptian religion. Yeah.
Yeah. Clive, did you want to throw something else in there?
It's only really to say that whenever we deal with the gospel stories and the stories of the miracles, we have to remember with all... Yeah, the text as we have them were written down maybe a generation later by people that weren't actually there and saw these things. They were relying on stories that had been passed down to them that they obviously believed to be true. But a lot of the stories, the stories of the miracles in particular, they're either kind of symbolic or in some cases just bits of folklore that have grown up about Jesus. And it's something we explore in quite a lot of detail in the book that's to come, the next book. But essentially, when it comes down to it, it's only really the healing miracles, the cures, and the exorcisms, the casting out of demons, that you can really say that's something that Jesus was known for and he did. You know, that's what he was in a way famous for. What his original popularity, his original thing was based on. Once you start moving outside that into did he walk on water, you start to look at things. Say the only people that saw him walk on water apparently were the disciples. The crowds didn't see that. So was this just something the disciples said? You go into an area of uncertainty. It's really it's the cures and the exorcisms, which are the things that seem to have some independent witnesses for. You know, so that's really where we come from. As I say, when you step away from that, the evidence becomes a lot more hazy.
Wildcard line, Paula is on Coast to Coast AM for Clive and Lynn. Go ahead, Paula.
Yeah, hi, Clive, Lynn.
Hi, Paula.
I was very glad to hear y'all on tonight. I have some information if you want it. I'm from the House of David. Okay, mm-hmm. And there is a book that you can go to about our whole family history. Okay, is Germany a lost tribe of ancient Israel? And there was a Merovingian dynasty. Okay, and Charlemagne took it over. It was from 129 to 768 A.D. And then Odin and Freya brings David and Zara's ancestry to the major house of Europe, and then the Hurrian, the Vandal kings, and then Carolingian dynasty of Charlemagne after that. And but I just thought you might want to know. You can go to Canada and get this from Cook and Spearman. They have the whole history there.
We never said there wasn't a Merovingian dynasty. What we actually said was that there is no connection between the Merovingians and the bloodline of Jesus.
Yeah, there is. And he had three children. He had two sons and a daughter.
Paula, we'd be very, we absolutely fascinated by what you're saying. Where do you get the idea that he had three children from?
Because I know my family history, okay?
Where is it written down?
It's in the family history that the family has, okay?
Okay.
There's a cousin of mine that's over in Utah that she's in the family too, from Amsterdam, and she's got an awful lot of it. And but anyway, the thing is, he had a son named Judah. And another one called Jesus Justice, and his daughter was named Sarah. Mm-hmm. And Joseph Arimathea took care of her until she married. Mm-hmm. And but anyway, matter of fact...
Paula, wouldn't that make you an ancestor of Jesus?
He's got a lot of children, hon. He's got over 1,000.
I get that. But, I mean, wouldn't that make you an ancestor of Jesus?
I know I am. My husband is, too. He's in the House of David, too.
Oh, well, that's interesting.
But as a matter of fact, it's in our family history. God was told us this was supposed to happen. He told David that Gad and David would intermarry till the time of Shiloh.
All right. Well, I appreciate that, and thank you. I think it's a good tip for Clive and Lynn if they want to follow up. Wild card line, Ed is on Coast to Coast AM for Clive and Lynn. Go ahead, Ed.
Good morning, Ian. Good morning, Lynn.
Good morning, Clive. Good morning.
I have two questions, actually. I was wondering if both of you, or all three of you, may have been familiar with the book from the 60s called The Passover Plot.
Yes.
Sure. It was written by a biblical scholar who suggested that it was a political conspiracy created by Jesus, who was a rabbi who wanted to create an overthrow of the Roman government, as did many Jews at the time. And that just became later on, when the Greeks translated everything and wanted to make Zeus the god, said Jesus, Zeus from Jesus, Jesus. They named him the god, the godhead. Anyway, that's part of looking into. Also, I had a question. If you guys are familiar with the Skull and Bones Secret Society in America and our last presidential election in which the two candidates were members of the Secret Society, as well as previous presidents in America who were connected to the royal family of England. Almost all of them have been and are and will be, perhaps.
All right, well, let's get to that question. I think it's a good one. So are you familiar with the Skull and Bones, Clive and Lynn?
Yes. We certainly are. Interestingly, it seems to be something that's becoming more and more known. If you went back 10 or 15 years, you only find the Skull and Bones written about, and shall we say, the kind of, you know, the fringe literature that the mainstream would dismiss. But now, I don't know if you, what was that movie that came out last year? Good Shepherd, you know, about the CIA.
Right.
And which the Skull and Bones features really prominently, and you think, well, it's crossing into the mainstream. Skull and Bones certainly exists. Whether it's, you know, it's kind of like this a club for the advantaged and privileged children of rich families to you know, help each other out in their future careers. Whether it's something more sinister, I don't know. But the very fact, you know, the fact is that the Skull and Bones, you know, being a member of it does clearly give you advantages in the political and business world, because, you know, you're all kind of pledged to help each other.
Can I just say that it's being related to the British royal family won't necessarily help you. I'm just thinking about present Prince Michael of Kent, who, you know, is a businessman, and basically, according to the newspapers here, you know, his businesses aren't doing too well. So he's a direct member of the royal family.
Yeah, and he's not getting a break. International caller Bradley on Coast to Coast AM for Clive and Lynn. Bradley?
Hello, Bradley.
How are you doing?
Fine, thank you.
Very well.
I just love Mr. Punnett's show.
Thank you.
So do we.
So do we, yes.
He always touches on things that seem to strike me right in the heart.
Mm. Good. Well, what can we get for you here in the time that we have?
Well, I was just wondering if your guests have ever heard of word tell of anything to do with Templar swords being discovered in Nova Scotia.
Oh, that's a great question. Yeah, anything about the Templars and the whole exploration of the United States? Have you ever come across that, or Canada?
We've read the books that, you know, the same books that probably you've read and a lot of your listeners have read. We wouldn't say anything we can add to that that's original to ours, any new insights. But, you know, there is certainly some evidence that you know, of Templar involvement. Evidence, I won't say it's absolutely conclusive, but you know, we were talking earlier about the missing fleet. Did it go to America? Well, it had to go somewhere. Somewhere it would never turn up again.
Are we talking about the carved rock? Are we talking about the carving in that rock? Because that's way cool. Hang on a second. We'll be back. We want to get everybody else that we can. We'll line up all the callers for Lynn Picknett and Clive Prince. We'll give you all the numbers you need to, for you to find a way to join us for the time that we have on all of their Knights Templar research, their latest in their book coming up on the differences between the gospel stories when it comes to John the Baptist and Jesus, plus their Turin Shroud stuff too. Never know where it's going to go on Coast to Coast AM. Let's go east of the Rockies right away, because George has been hanging on for a while in Manhattan on Coast to Coast AM for Clive and Lynn. Go ahead, George.
Good morning, Ian. Deus Tiamat.
Oh, thank you.
Always wanted to say that. I've been listening to you for a long time now.
Thank you.
And love it that you're on the weekends too. Both Sabbaths, you know, the Old Testament,
right.
New Testament. You're covering the whole market here.
We are tonight.
All right. Full disclosure. Yeah, I was born Christian. Was in my late adolescence. I mean, as a teen. Between agnosticism and atheism. But then I re-found, you know, the basis. But, you know, I, for the last, and I'm retired now, I've been studying religions, and I've run across books and stuff that have given me this idea. And I know they're talking about the Shroud of Turin and things like that, and the Knights Templar, but and all different faiths and the inconsistencies of faiths. What I find when I talk to friends of all different faiths is that I don't try to argue and tell them my position. What I try to do is understand what their faith is, because I think the truth is symphonic. And there was a wonderful historian of religion that wrote the name of the book is Truth is Symphonic, and it's a history of religion starting before Judaism. I mean, you know, the pagans, and then and then covering the whole world. You know, medicine men in Africa and the whole nine yards, and how it's a giant symphony that the Creator has written. Now, if you're a believer in a Creator, then all of these so-called coincidences and so on. I mean, maybe Jesus was given the gift from his father of getting the guy with the best-looking face, you know, who happened to be Leonardo.
Leonardo da Vinci.
I mean, you know, we don't know, you know, what came first, the chicken or the egg, right?
Well, but, that's an interesting thought. Well, let's get the response to that. And okay. What do you think of that theory?
Right.
Clive,
well, I mean, yes, anything is possible, absolutely. However, I doubt very much from our reading of it, George, that God would have chosen Leonardo for that task, because Leonardo wasn't doing it out of love for the religion. He did it quite the opposite reason. And, you know, according to our research, he was actually a John the Baptist man, which means that, I mean, he was a Johannite, so he really despised Jesus. It was, you know, that's what the Johannites were like. They were quite extreme. So Leonardo was not doing it out of love for Jesus. In fact, there is this thing which we always talk about, George, that it's a big joke, actually, a sort of cosmic joke through history, in a way, that Leonardo created, you know, put his own face on this alleged holy relic, which has been prayed over for centuries and still is. And the people don't know, but they are praying over basically the face of a, you know, a 15th century homosexual heretic. So it's you know, it's not quite as you imagine, I'm afraid.
Well, how about heretic prankster too?
Yeah.
Put it that way. All right, well, I appreciate it. We'll take a break. We'll get everybody else in coming up next for Lynn and Clive on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Let's go west of the Rockies for Jim in San Francisco for Lynn Picknett and Clive Prince. You can hook up to them through coasttocoastam.com. Jim?
Hello there. I've got a question for y'all. Did the Templars have any interaction with the Ark of the Covenant at all?
That's a good question.
Answer off the air.
I like that question, Jim. That's interesting. Go ahead.
There were all kinds of theories about what the Templars were about and what their secrets were. You know, did they have the Holy Grail? Did they have the Ark of the Covenant? And so on. And in all of these cases, you know, there's a couple of books been written sort of linking the Templars to the Ark of the Covenant. And it's one of those things that in the end you can't prove it, but you can build a very good case. And, of course, the Ark of the Covenant being, you know, given the military advantages it gave people, is the kind of thing the Templars would have gone looking for. So the idea that they went looking for these kind of things, there's a lot of evidence that the Templars generally, apart from their role of, you know, fighting, you know, defending the pilgrims and defending the Holy Land, went looking for knowledge, any kind of knowledge that would help them in any way. You know, medical knowledge, very good for, you know, something you really need for a military order, anything that would give them advantage in fighting, but also knowledge just for knowledge's sake. So they're researching all kinds of stuff, and you know, I think there's very little doubt that with that desire to find out things, desire to for knowledge, given now you've got access to you know, the lands that were spoken about in the Bible and all the secrets that were spoken about in the Bible, they would have gone looking for the Ark of the Covenant, I'm sure of it. Whether they found it or not,
I mean, let's not forget the Ark of the Covenant, according to the Old Testament, could fry whole armies. So that would come in handy for a bunch of soldiers, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, I think
whether they found it or not, that's where you kind of, maybe not. You know, you need someone to actually kind of show you either a document there. Or show you the hiding place. Sure. But it's certainly very likely. You know.
Let's go first-time caller line. Ted is in North Carolina on Coast to Coast AM for Clive and Lynn. Go ahead, Ted.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning, Ted.
There was actually a caller last night who mentioned something called the Box Saga.
Yeah.
And it relates to the Knights Templar in a way. The whole idea behind what these people are saying is that there was this vast civilization before a cataclysmic flood event, and that there are still remnants of it somewhere in the world. But they say that all holy bloodlines come from a people who survived that time. And they actually put forth the idea, and I don't know if I agree with the other things they say, but that the bloodline conspiracies mentioned with the Priory of Sion and the Knights Templar actually comes from those royal families which predate all the other ones.
Did you go to
and,
the website?
And one of them that was mentioned was the Meru.
Right. Did you go to the website last night? We put the link up. Did you get to the website?
Yeah, I checked that out when I got home from work in the morning.
It's kind of interesting. I don't know whether Clive and Lynn know about it. Do you know what he's talking about, the Box Saga?
No, I'm afraid I don't.
Not specifically. I mean, there's a lot of things about bloodlines around, but no, never come across that. So.
Ted, what was it again? It was BOCKSAGA, Box Saga.
Yeah, that's right.
Right. That's the website, BoxSaga.com.
Really radical ideas, I don't know.
But I mean, as you probably gather, we're not great fans of the Holy Bloodline idea anyway.
They say it doesn't come from Jesus, but, you know, other royal families. It is a Holy Bloodline, but it has nothing to do with any Christian or...
Right.
Yeah, well, we tend to be very cautious about any bloodline claims, because when you get down to it, you think, what are you saying? You're saying some people are better than the rest of us because of the family they were born into, and I think... I mean, to us, we've actually spent a long time, many centuries, trying to get rid of that idea, trying to move away from that idea, to kind of reintroduce it and say that, you know, some people should be listened to more than others, right. Some people have abilities that are better than others, whatever, or a right to rule. So I know we still have a royal family here, but it's something that, you know, really we've been moving away from. So anyone... Whenever people start talking about bloodlines and special families, we always get very cautious and say, you know, exactly what is being claimed of these people? Why should being born into this family make somebody better or even more interesting?
And of course, the opposite of that is that, I mean, by implication, other people are worse than them because of families that they've been born into. So actually, it's a very, very dangerous idea.
I had this, I ran into this problem about 6 months ago when I had an occasion to spend a few minutes on the phone with Sarah, the Duchess of York.
Oh, yeah.
And they had all these rules. They faxed all these rules over of all the ways I can address her and the ways that I can't address her and the things I can say and the things I can't say. And I was really struggling with it because I thought, okay, if I'm in England, that would make sense. But in America, I mean, she's just another schmo, you know, selling... Yeah. Stuff on commercials on TV. Yep. She's somebody else doing Weight Watchers. Mm-hmm. You know, she's just like the rest of us.
Well, yeah, yep.
So, I mean, I don't know.
We have a constitutional monarchy, which means that despite all the pomp and circumstance, essentially the queen has to do as she's told.
I know, but it's still weird that they send rules over of how I'm supposed to talk to her. And I thought,
And
in her case, I mean, she married into it. She wasn't even born into it.
Right. Wildcard line, Charles is in Arkansas on Coast to Coast AM for Clive and Lynn. Charles?
Hi. It's glad to talk to y'all. I've had questions. I like to get deep into the Bible. I have been saved, and then I had a walk with the Lord back about 4 years ago. And my question is, when it comes to the mark of the beast, you know, a lot of people put a lot of theory into this idea. I'm really far from the chip idea. I'm basically getting my information from the old Greek as a imprint or an embossing, and I keep coming back down to it's your fingerprints. Everyone's already got them there anyway. Nothing will have to put into your body. It's just once you take your fingers and use those as an identifier for you for your bank account or anything for your identity, then... Is that then you, once you do that, could that be the drawing line of you taking the mark of the beast?
Let me take that question. Hey, let me just ask a quick question. Are fingerprints God-given?
Yes, they are.
Then how could that be the mark of the beast?
Well, you're given the mark for you in your hand as a, let's put it this way, it's something that was given to you by God, but taken yeah. over by the demonic part of the world to use as.
But it can't be a mark of the beast. But it can't be a mark of the beast.
Well, the beast is the controller of Earth itself.
Okay.
You know, like where your computers all back up to the beast anyway.
Okay.
And
well, thanks for that thought. All right. Well, I think God is omnipotent. I'll leave it at that. Let me go wildcard line. AJ is in L.A. for Clive and Lynn on Coast to Coast AM. AJ?
Yes. Good morning. Great show. Yes. I'd like to get the two questions answered. Number one, I'd like to get your opinion of what you have heard thus far in relation to the question that I'm going to ask, which is, based upon your guest's conclusion, would you still say that what they have concluded makes the Bible untrue, or is it still truly the inspired Word of God? And how does what they have stated affect your belief system, or does it not? So,
yeah. Are you talking to me?
Yes, sir.
Oh, okay. I'll just say I think there's a difference between faith and what I'll think about, what I'll believe, I reserve for a very short list of things that I will put my faith into. What I'll think about is all sorts of stuff, and I love to think about different things because it pushes the way in which I look at the world, and out of that only comes good, I believe, at least for me, that's been the case. And so I would separate out and say I love to think about what Lynn and Clive have been talking about. What I believe, I'll put into a kind of a separate hopper. But I'll always read what they do because it's well-researched and it's well-argued. And I think that's always fun. Keeps me sharp. And no, I can't remember. What was the other question? What was the, did I get them both in there?
Yes. Well, in conclusion, just okay. Summarizing. I have to say that if what you are saying, your guests are saying is, then the Bible is either a lie or it's a fabrication.
That's what I'm saying. That's what you're getting at. Oh, no, I'll just say I don't believe that. And I think it's interesting to say that I think things can be truthful without being factual. And
okay.
I think that the Bible often points to truths and teaches us truths, but they may not be facts.
It may not be
based on a factual event. And I think we have evidence for that in all sorts of ways in our society, and I think that's the way we communicate information sometimes. We learn truths even through fiction, and that's certainly true. If you go back to Aesop, you can even look at it that way, that, you know, those are true things that were passed along in a fictional way in the case of Aesop's tales. And I'm not saying the Bible is full of tales at all, but I'm just saying that doesn't necessarily mean one is true over the other. Let's go to Sonny in North Carolina on Coast to Coast AM for Lynn and Clive. Sonny?
Good morning.
Good morning, Sonny.
Good morning. Interesting program. I wanted to go back to a comment that your guest made on the previous hour regarding the Magnificat in Luke's Gospel. And we're saying that the earliest manuscripts mention the name of Elizabeth, or rather attributed the Magnificat to Elizabeth, the mother of John the Baptist, rather than to Mary. And in my reading of the Greek New Testament, and looking up the references to which name appears most often and which of the citations, the only manuscripts in which it appears are the old Latin versions, and the earliest of those goes back to the 4th century. On the other hand, you have a vast citation for the name of Mariam or Maria appearing in Greek, you know, the various different Greek manuscripts. Okay. And the Greek certainly is, you know, manuscripts are, for the most part, much older than the old Latin versions.
Sure. Go ahead, Lynn, Clive.
The Greek manuscripts, I mean, the earliest complete manuscripts of any Bible that we have are 3rd century, so, you know, quite a time after. About 300 years after Jesus' time. And there were some fragments filling in the gaps in between that. But what we also have is, you know, very early writings of the very kind of early church fathers, the first Christians, who wrote kind of commentaries on the Bible or discussed points of the Bible. And if you actually look at those very early writings, when they talk about the Magnificat, they talk about it being Elizabeth's song, or, you know, attributed to Elizabeth. And then there's a point where they start to have a little debate amongst themselves about whether it's Elizabeth or whether it's actually Mary. And these are all things, these take place before the earliest, you know, the earliest actual copies of the Bible that you can hold, or the New Testament that you can hold, are, you know, from about 300 years after Jesus' time. But the bit in between, so we don't actually have those earliest manuscripts, but we do have early Christian theologians and church leaders writing to each other, discussing these things, and the earliest references are to Elizabeth. So then there's a point when they start to debate, should it be Elizabeth or should it be Mary? And then there's a point where they've decided it's Mary. But added to that, there's also the fact that if you look at the words of the Magnificat, they're much more relevant to Elizabeth's situation than they are to Mary's. And there's a whole lot of evidence that that's how things started out.
All right, we'll just have time for Stephen in Kentucky. That was a good answer, Clive, but I don't want to miss Stephen, who's been hanging on yep. Coast to Coast AM. Right. Go ahead, Stephen.
Yes, sir, thank you. Two real quickies. Number one, do they agree with the authors that 4 years ago that said that they had evidence that the Saunier got the money from promising masses that no way in the world he could deliver on? And number two, could Jesus and Paul, as Eichhorn claims, Jesus and Paul be the same person? Thank you.
Just one thing about Saunier. He did get money from saying masses, or at least promising to say masses, but he also got money from donations from a great many individuals. And to us, the big secret, the big mystery, if you like, is why they gave him those donations.
Okay. And the quick Jesus-Paul theory, anybody? No? Okay. Sorry about that, and we'll just have to strand the rest of everybody else that wanted to get through. Did our best with that. Thank you so much. Always enjoy talking to you. I hope it's not another 2 years before we talk again.
Indeed. We've had a lovely time. Thank you.
Great fun. Good. Thanks. Can't believe how quickly it goes.
It has. It has gone. It's flown by. And I want to go take a look at the updated works of Clive Prince and Lynn Picknett. Link up to them through Coast to Coast AM. .com. And however you're going to celebrate it, in any way you do it, I hope you have a happy holiday. Okay?
And you too.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And all your listeners.
Thank you. And and look forward to next Friday night, where we'll do open lines again for George to get another long weekend off. And a week from tonight, more rock and roll mysteries with Gary Patterson and a special guest on Coast to Coast AM. Deus te amat, and I do too.